This is Geographical Imagination's radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. I'm your host, Kevin S. Fox, coming to you from Studio O, just north of Philadelphia, in the great Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Tonight's episode, we invite Spanish scholar Javier Cardeña to join us for this episode 60. We call it Going Back to an Empty House. Javier is a specialist in Irish and Scottish storytelling traditions, and in his doctoral thesis work, introduced the Spanish-speaking world to the oral tradition of the Scottish tinkers, namely through the work of Duncan Williamson. A multilinguist, I first met Javi in 2009 at a summer Irish Gaelic immersion course in the northwest of Ireland in County Donegal, where we would take a break from the grammar lessons and take a pint of the black stuff or a walk in the hills, but usually not in that order. I asked him to talk with me over Skype, like we did back in those days, when we would plow through a wide range of themes and let the dialogue threads weave back into themselves. So here we are with Javier Cardeña from Madrid. We're going to try something different. This is what may very well be our last episode, number 60, the end of season 5. Why not try something new even on the last episode? And I've come up with a list of 13 possible topics, things I know that may be of interest to Javier, and that I've perhaps spoken with him about in the past, and some things not. And I've just sent him the list of 13 themes just 2 hours ago, and then I've put those 13 themes in a randomizer, so he doesn't know the order in which they're going to come. A little bit of a fun way to go through a wide and diverse range of topics. So the first one is Antonio Machado's Caminante.
Antonio Machado was a secondary school teacher of French. But at the same time, he's probably one of the most wonderful and acknowledged poets in Spain. But the good thing about him is that he can combine philosophical thought with something that is not very clearly kind of defined, but it's always with us, which is like the body, or which is our feet, yes? Uh-huh. So he's a very, in a way, very simple poet, but in a very good way. He's a man who really likes to be understood, but at the same time, he likes to convey a message that is beyond, that goes to your soul, that is deep, with very simple words. So in a way, he is the poet of the people, which I think is amazing.
Who is his caminante? What is the caminante?
I think it's a person who never arrives, who is always walking. The only goal that one person can have is the road, is the way. Not we are always like obsessed with going places or to reaching places. Yeah.
Yeah.
We always tend to do it in the least amount of time, and we don't like pay attention to the way, to the road. Yeah. Even on our holidays, we don't pay so much attention. Yeah, if you go to to Thailand, you are always obsessed with going to the next city, and I think it's a much more accurate if you think about it as a way. As the road, as the person's like travels, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. As the person's determination, as the randomness of exploring new places.
Yeah.
As just putting one foot after another. And I think that's what El Caminante is for him, day after day, one foot after another.
Good. So it's interesting, the randomizer here, choosing the order of our 13 topics, has chosen something which would create tension with the definition of Caminante that you've offered up. And that's, what does it mean to have a pueblo in Spain? When someone says, someone from Madrid, for instance, talks about their pueblo, what does that mean?
Well, in Madrid, we are all immigrants in a way, you know?
Yeah.
We are all people whose parents come from this pueblo, come from the rural areas, yeah?
Yeah.
And actually, these like rural areas now are more or less empty. So we can call this phenomenon the empty Spain. Spain is very empty. Actually, the center of Spain, like both Castilla and La Rioja and some other regions, are incredibly empty. I think the like density of like population there is very, very low. With Ireland and with Laponia, with a part of Finland,
yeah,
they are the
least
the areas of Europe. Uh-huh. That have the low level of density, of the population density.
Right.
So it has to do with that. It has to do with our parents or our grandparents coming to Madrid without knowing anything and being scared. Hmm. And that's a very important word, I think, there, is the fear.
Yeah.
And the kind of respect with fear, you know, that they had when they first came here. So everyone says with a little bit of pride, I have a pueblo, and my pueblo is this. And actually, when I want to connect with my students, you know, in a, well, at a personal level, I tend to talk about my pueblo, or I tend to ask them questions about their pueblo. Where are you from? Where do your parents come from? Because almost everyone has a pueblo.
It's part of and someone's identity.
Yeah, it's a part of their identity, and it's a safe place. Hmm. It's a safe place, and it has to do with that, you know, with the city. A place where, in a way, our ancestors were forced to come, but we fear, you know, like being scared because they didn't know, like, for example, like what to do or like their professions that they were going to have. They were only used to like working the land or things like that, you know, and but for us now, it's a way of trying to get rid of our rootlessness. I think we all feel a little bit rootless, and we want to reconstruct our identity, which sometimes it's a fake process, you know, because you aren't going to rebuild your identity because you haven't actually been brought up there.
Right.
But you have a feeling at the same time that you don't belong there, you don't belong here either. Hmm. So it's a way of going back and going to the pueblo, what makes us. Sometimes it's also a place of freedom, yeah? We go back, it's safer, it has to do with our ancestors, it has to do with our blood. So it's like a shelter for us, I think.
Now, there's a monument in Madrid where people famously, or people will very often use as a meeting point. here we are, we're talking about community. And in Madrid itself, it's the symbol of Madrid. In fact, El Madroño is a bear. Well, people just colloquially will say El Madroño, I'll meet you there. But it's the symbol of Madrid. It's a bear leaning up against this specific tree. What does Madroño do for the Madrileño, the person from Madrid?
Actually, Madroño for us doesn't mean a lot because it's actually, I mean, you can't see this specific tree and you can't see the bear, you know?
Anymore.
Because, like, there are no bears in Madrid and there are no Madroños in Madrid. So what happens there is that for us, it's, I suppose, a symbol of the lost history, you know?
Yeah.
And actually also has to do with rebuilding, you know? Because Madrid was rebuilt, because Madrid wasn't the capital, you know what I mean?
Right.
But so it's a way of probably stating that Madrid is much older and that it has always been there. Although sometimes it hasn't been like the capital of Spain.
Right.
It has always been there. It has had a very deep history. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
So, but only like the meeting point is important for us. It's like more specific. It's like, if you want to meet someone, you go there with these lost symbols, but also they mean that our history is older, or they mean that we have lost things, but at the same time we are constantly rebuilding, like the place. Yeah?
Another symbol, and this is probably all of Spain. And it's probably woven into the fabric of, you know, discussions and debates and the way people think about themselves as being from Spain and its long history of art and literature. Number four on our list, and to talk about this in 4 minutes probably is kind of a joke, but Quixote.
Oh, Quixote. So, well, it's a universal figure, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's also very Spanish, which I have always caught my eye, you know, because it's a very Spanish figure, as Sancho Panza is, but at the same time it has become a universal one. El Quijote is the dreamer. El Quijote is a person who believes that another world is possible, yeah? Who believes in the world of ideas, who is not very attached to this material world, you know?
Yeah.
And he lives inside his dreams. He lives inside his head. And that's why he's crazy, or he's portrayed as a crazy person. Because what Cervantes is saying, that when you are attached to your dreams or to your thoughts, if you are too attached, you can't connect with the real world. So this real world is going to consider you a mad person, or a flamboyant character, But what Cervantes is addressing there is also that probably you are going to be, if you are going to be like this kind of person, you are going to believe in values that most people don't pay attention to. So you have some values. It has to do with Platonic values, with the world of the ideas, with all these kind of concepts. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So El Quijote believes in some values that are at that time forgotten, that are at that time excluded from society, or that are old-fashioned, you know,
yeah.
Because he dresses himself
a knight,
as a knight, you know, yeah. And a knight. I mean, of course, it was so old-fashioned that like people were mocking at him and laughing. And,
right.
But it also has to do with the romantic love. Yeah, he is in love with like Dulcinea, whereas he meets a lot of people who are more interested in having, I mean, let's call it short relationships. Yeah.
Right.
So. In a way, all these values that El Quijote has are very good values, but they are no longer so present in our society. So it's like we should be like him, but at the same time, we have to be like down to earth, like Sancho Panza. So I suppose he... You know, since life is a very complex thing, probably what Cervantes was saying, that you have to have like a middle ground and everything. But you shouldn't be like Sancho Panza at all times either, you know? Because if you are like Sancho Panza at all times, you don't chase your dreams, you don't have inner thoughts about life. You don't have a lot of values. You are always this kind of rascal, this kind of rogue, that like Sancho Panza is sometimes, or that is like La Traya de Tormes, or that they have like to survive. And in order to survive, you do things. You can steal food. You can lie to people. You can, whereas the knight, whereas like Don Quixote, is not going to do that, because he has a lot to think about. He has a lot to believe in. He has a lot to dream. He needs all these kind of things. He lives in a separate world. And, you know, when he wakes up, usually he's woken up by violence in El Quijote. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
It's like sometimes when we have a friend of ours who is a believer and who always wants to believe in that world of ideas, sometimes we tap on his forehead, yeah?
Right.
Like, come on, wake up. So that is what happens.
Yeah.
He does it with violence always.
Number five.
But I could talk about El Quijote, and
we'll do a full episode on Quijote. Number five is an interesting one to me, because I've noticed it, having lived in Spain at different times. Spain's love of Wild West films from the Old West of the United States, before maybe, well, I guess it was the United States there, but the territory, they weren't necessarily states yet in that time. Why does Spain love Wild West films?
It has to do with having a pueblo.
Yeah.
Because I think we love them because it's a way, because I think it's because of the landscapes.
Yeah.
You know, in the landscapes of these films, you can see that there are not a lot of people. So it's like this Spain that we have lost. It's like this rural Spain. It's this España vacía, this empty Spain. Yeah.
Yeah.
And this empty Spain is what was there. I mean, John Wayne was there, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And in those kind of, like, Western films,
yeah,
there weren't, like, a lot of people, and they were always traveling. They were always going places. They were always chasing things, yeah?
Right.
So it's probably like the same landscape as like these pueblos, but with a journey, which is something that probably these people were longing for. Yeah.
Yeah. Number six, I want to move into something that is closer to your own research a little bit. Number six came up as the personage, the character here, Eddie Davies, Tinker and Pearl, the Tinker and Pearl Fisher. I'm assuming you've come across this person, or at least stories of him from your research on Scotland and storytelling.
Yeah, he wasn't much of a storyteller, but I met him. I met him when he was 90 years old. And the most interesting thing about him is his personal history.
Yeah.
He was a tinker, but not all the tinkers were pearl fishers. Actually, not a lot of them were fishing pearls in the lochs or in the rivers. Yeah? Uh-huh. So he started because his father saw one of the tinkers like doing that, and he was a little bit sick and tired of his life. Yeah? So he decided that he wanted like to give it a try, because it was a good way of making money, and also it was a good way of not having a boss. Because, you know, like tinkers were wandering around and they had a very free life and everything. But they are also called the summer walkers. And why are they called that? Because they were sometimes hired by the lords of Scotland, and they were sometimes hired during the summer. So it was a good way of getting rid of this kind of life. Yeah, never working, not in the winter, and not during the summer. I mean, never working again for a person or for a non-traveler person, which is important. It's an important concept, yeah?
Right.
Because usually they saw them as people who weren't evolved. I mean, thinkers thought that people who were not evolved like them, they had to live at a permanent place, you know? And they were better in a way, because they were living like around, yeah?
Yeah.
Because they were usually traveling, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So Eddie Davies started that with his father when like, he was a child. He started like pearl fishing, but when I met him, all his relatives had died. And he had a very lonely life. He told me that he, like 20 years ago, he stopped working as a pearl fisher. Well, 30 years ago, I think. Yeah, yeah. Like in the 60s, well, in the 70s. Because there was a ban. And it has an interesting story, because people were banned from fishing pearls in the rivers of Scotland, yeah?
Huh.
Because one of them found the what is called the Big Pearl.
Yeah.
And that Big Pearl, the legend says, that was bought by the Queen of England, yeah?
Yeah.
So it was on the radio, which is true. So, like, there is a part of the story that is a legend, and there is a part of the story that is real, yeah?
Uh-huh.
So what is real is that someone found like the Big Pearl and sold it at a very high price. And it was on the news, on the radio at that time. And everyone started going. Everyone started like going there, like all the families, a lot of families in England and in Scotland.
Right.
Everyone wanted to travel to those rivers to fish a pearl and then sell it at a very high price and be rich or yeah,
right,
or have some money. So then there was like this ban, because all these people, we call them like domingueros, which is like people who go on a hike on Sunday. Right. You know what I mean?
Right, right, of course.
Like, do you have these kind of people in the US?
Sure.
So they never travel, you know? They have a from 9 to 5 job, but then on Sunday they go to La Sierra, or they go like to the mountains, and then they, but it's not really a journey, or it's not really, it's just a trip. It's just a family trip. It's just something that you want to like enjoy with your relatives. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So I suppose that these like domingueros, these families who also went on a hike in Scotland, a lot of them went there, or a lot of people, yeah?
Yeah.
And they were polluting the rivers.
Right, of course.
So, after the ban, he couldn't work anymore. And that was a hard blow for him, because he was a pearl fisher. It has to do with his identity, yeah?
Right.
So, basically, what Eddie Davies like means for me is a person who was deprived of his identity because of sedentary people, who didn't respect the rivers, who didn't control, who didn't respect like the nature, and who were throwing away food or right, whatever on the rivers, and they were polluted, and then came the ban. Yeah, so.
Yeah. Number.
But the most poetic profession of the travelers, yeah, and I like it.
Number 7, maybe a place for sedentary people to eat a lot. There's a place in Lavapiés in Madrid where you can eat what's called La Zapatilla, and the place is called Bar Mellos. What do you have to say about La Zapatilla?
Well, you haven't eaten a whole zapatilla, and I haven't eaten a whole zapatilla. So I suppose it's a disappointment for our listeners. Yeah, basically it's a bar that serves la zapatilla, that serves a very big dish that it has I think 3 layers of bread.
Uh-huh.
With cheese, with like melted cheese and York ham, and it's very, very tasty, yeah? But I suppose that what strikes you is the name of La Zapatilla, yeah?
That's correct.
Because...
What's the translation of it?
The translation, it could be the sneaker,
uh-huh,
or which I... But I don't believe in that translation. I believe because zapatilla has another word, the slipper.
The slipper. La pantufla.
I think it's more the slipper, because it has to do with like feeling comfortable at home wearing like some slippers. Yeah.
Right, because it's comfort food. All that cheese and ham and bread.
Yeah.
And just for the listeners. A full zapatilla would be like a size in European sizes, probably like a 48, something like that. And in America,
48, yeah.
In American sizes, like a 13 or 14. So picture like the sole of that sneaker or shoe, and that's the size of the bread for the sandwich. And it's just full. Bar Mellos. They don't pay us for any advertising, but if you're in Madrid and go to Lavapiés, the neighborhood, you should try a zapatilla. You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, where each month we venture into the geographies of everything and nothing.
For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode.
Number eight brings us back to your translation work and work in Scotland, but it's really the major work of yours that's also been published in a book about the Witch of the Sea. Maybe I'm loosely translating that, but it's about the stories of Duncan Williamson. Tell us about translation itself, and especially with Duncan Williamson.
Well, traduttore, traditore, yeah?
Yeah.
Translator, betrayer. Huh. But in my case, it has always been a struggle because I don't want to betray, yeah?
Right.
I am very concerned about this because they have a way of speaking. These travelers, and it's oral, you know? So if you get rid of all these features, which sometimes are like grammatical mistakes or sometimes are, you know, but you get rid of all the richness of that speech, yeah?
Yeah.
So, well, you know, so I had to make some decisions that were against that. So, but there's always been a constant struggle in my translations of these oral stories, oral legends, trying to transmit, but at the same time, not losing this identity that all the tales are made up of. Yeah? All the tales like contain these features. Yeah? One of them is like, for example, they tell sometimes the stories as a mixture in between the present and the past. So sometimes they use past tenses and sometimes they use present tenses, you know?
Uh-huh.
And when you use present tenses, when you tell a story, it's usually... Well, I think for any kind of reader, but for the Spanish reader, it's sometimes very confusing, you know,
mm-hmm.
because we don't usually like tell the stories and with like present tenses, because it sounds like a joke, you know?
Right.
Well, I mean, when we tell jokes, we use the present tense,
right.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
But when we tell stories, we usually use the past tenses. So, for example, one of the things that I had to do was to put more or less all the tenses in the past. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
But there are other features that I haven't touched. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Even some friends of mine like, have told me, oh, but that sounds a little bit weird. But it's weird because it's part of an oral tradition. It's part of how, like, the storyteller tells the story. It's part of their heritage. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it has always been this kind. But my edition is not clean. You know, it has to have some dirt to be good.
Yeah.
It has to have this authenticity. It has to have this feeling. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So. But translation is always jumping into the void. It's jumping into the unknown territory.
Yeah.
So you are going to take risks, and it's always, in my opinion, a constant struggle to keep the balance between even your essence as a writer and his essence as a writer or a storyteller, because we shouldn't like neglect the fact that a lot of translators are writers themselves,
right?
And it's not I don't really like sometimes the word translation, because it means that all the weight falls on the author. Sometimes it's better rewriting, reconstructing. I prefer that. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like having like this material, but at the same time, re-elaborate it. Yeah.
You've provided me with the perfect segue for number 9, which is, and you've previously commented on the poor translation of movie titles from English to Spanish. And so how would you rewrite the title of the movie Shawshank Redemption, which in its Spanish translation has been called what? Life Sentence, Cadena Perpetua, or something like that.
Life Sentence, yeah.
How would you translate Shawshank Redemption?
And this is
number 9 on our list. Yeah.
You brought up a very interesting topic, because when Spanish people have tried to translate these titles in English, in English you can have a title that is very simple, you know? Like, for example, I've always been a fan of this film, The Miller's Crossing.
Yeah.
You can't have that in Spain. You can't have a movie called El Cruce Miller, because who is Miller? You know what I mean?
Right.
And what, it's so simple for us that it's not going to bring any interest. I mean, they are not going to be like interested in that. I mean, all the viewers, yeah?
Right.
So our translation has been Muerte entre las Flores, which has to do with death among the flowers, or death in the flowers, yeah?
Yeah.
Which has to do with probably the most important scene of that film, yes?
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes I think it's good that we translate very, very freely. Because at the same time, what has happened there? These people who have decided to translate it this way have watched the film and have tried to understand like the movie, and have tried to like pinpoint the like most important scene. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And have tried to create a poetic flavor. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like death among the flowers, yeah, or death in the flowers, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So I think it's a cultural concept. I think it has to do with how we see the films, because for you as an American, that's more or less where you have, as an American viewer, you consider like the movies as something that is yours, yes?
Mm.
In Spain, and in La España Vacía, in this like empty Spain, in all these villages where our grandparents lived, movies were a miracle.
Yeah.
And it's something different. So you are going to sell the miracle as The Miller's Crossing? As El Cruce Miller? No. Because you can't sell that. It is a miracle, so it has to have a title that makes you think, or that makes you feel, or that is catchy. You know what I mean? So Shawshank Redemption, La Redención de Shawshank, the same thing happens there as it happens with The Miller's Crossing. Who is Miller and who is Shawshank?
Right.
That is the question that a Spanish viewer would ask himself or herself, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
What happens there, yeah? Because redemption is good, crossing is good, but Miller, Shawshank, what is that? It's not a city, it's just a name, yeah? So it doesn't have a particular relevance for us. So we should, these people have thought, let's try another title and let's translate it very freely. Let's watch the movie and try to come up with a more interesting title.
Number 10, interestingly enough, is kind of, I think it brings us a continuation of this talking about film and brings us to perhaps the most spoken about, certainly outside of Spain, Spanish director of the late 20th century and early 21st, and that's Almodóvar.
Almodóvar, I think Almodóvar and Woody Allen have a lot in common.
Uh-huh.
Because what happens to them is that they are very well regarded outside their country. So, like, for example, what happens with Woody Allen is that, for people in Spain, and I suppose that in a lot of countries in Europe, he is probably the best director or at least like one of the best like directors of this age, yeah?
Yeah.
And in the United States, he hasn't got a lot of awards or a lot of nominations, or you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
So the same thing happens with Almodóvar. Almodóvar is a universal filmmaker, yeah? Everyone loves, like, Almodóvar, yeah? A friend of mine in South Korea is a fan of him, yeah? He's that famous, yeah?
Right.
But he's not regarded in the same light in Spain, yeah? Which is a pity. Now he is beginning to be, like, recognized. But the same thing happens, I think, with Woody Allen in the U.S., yeah? Actually, that's what he says, that in a lot of that a lot of times he has shot his films in Europe.
Right, right.
Because he feels more at home. And actually, sometimes I think Almodóvar has had that feeling. Although he is very Spanish, he feels more at home, like abroad, you know what I mean? Like in France or even in the U.S. In the U.S. with Volver and with some other movies, a lot of Hollywood stars have said that they want to be on an Almodóvar's like movie, yeah?
Uh-huh.
But Almodóvar also deals with a topic which is Volver, which is going back. She's going back to his pueblo, yeah?
Yeah.
And he has Volver and he has his last movie, which is called Dolor y Gloria, mm-hmm. Pain and Glory.
Yeah.
Which also has to do with this theme of going back to his childhood, of the feeling of being completely aloof, you know, there, because he was inclined to be an artist. And he actually lived in some caves. Like, do you know that?
In caves?
Caves, huh. Yeah. He lived in a very poor and like deprived small town or village in La Mancha,
huh.
And the poorest people there lived in a kind of caves, you know? They lived underground, yeah? Yeah. Hmm. So there were caves that were, like, decorated, that they were like a house, but at the same time, like, they were caves and they were underground. So I think it's like a metaphor, yeah?
Yeah.
He was living there, and he was kind of looking at the sunlight, yeah, from the cave, from the underground, yeah. And that light has been Madrid, has been the world, has been his movies. But at the same time, he is still that boy, living inside a cave, being homosexual, mm-hmm. but not being able to express his sexuality in that village. Not being able to express his art in that village, not being able to do a lot of things because it was a small village and because it was underground and all these harsh conditions, I think, have defined him. Yeah.
Yeah. Number 11, it's a yes or no question. Is the bull the main, most central symbol of Spain? Yes
the
or
bull.
No? The bull.
No.
Number 12.
You know, I think it's the sun.
Oh, okay, the sun. Yeah, yeah. All right. Number 12. La Casa de Papel, which has an awful translation as well into English, but it's on Netflix. People could watch it in an English-speaking audience. If you want to watch it in its original, you can with subtitles, or you can hear it dubbed as well. Why is Casa de Papel so successful?
Because it has to do with corruption. And in Spain, one of our main topics of conversation is political corruption. And it has to do with the economical crisis. What strikes me in La Casa de Papel is that, and all the Spanish people can relate to the fact that they are going to rob this factory of making notes and of making millions of euros. Yeah?
Right.
So everyone can relate to them. Everyone can relate to that because all the characters have been mistreated, have been ill-treated by
the system,
by life and by the government and like by the crisis. So they want to take revenge. They want to have money. They want to do it without harming the other people.
Right.
So I think that's why La Casa de Papel is so successful because it's the dream of the common citizen.
Last question, number 13. Your favorite word, there's always when you're working between two languages, Spanish and English in this case, there's always words that just don't translate really well. They don't have a direct translation into the other language. Either way, English to Spanish or Spanish to English, what's your favorite word that does not have a real clean or, well, doesn't really have a direct translation?
Let me think. Probably, no. Cutre.
All right.
Cutre is very, very hard to translate. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it could be a place, and if it's a place, but. Well, it also has to do with the dirt, but it also has to do with, like, for example, like being a mean person. If you are a mean person, and you don't want to spend your money, or the waiter gives you, I don't know, like 2 cents as a change, and you keep them and you don't give like anything to him or to her, then you are cutre. But it also has to do with
a place,
with
too.
A house. Yeah. You know, a house can be cutre. It can be poorly like decorated house, but at the same time, it could be a house where no one has lived for years and years, or it could be a dirty place. So kutre is one of these words that are difficult to translate. But I've always been fond of this Fernweh, yeah? This Fernweh, which is German, yeah?
The German one, right.
For instance, yeah? This kind of concept. Or like Waldeinsamkeit. I don't know why, but I come up now with like German words. Mm-hmm. So like, sorry, Gavin, yeah?
It's
but
all right.
Waldeinsamkeit is the feeling of loneliness that you have in a forest.
Right, right.
And the other one, which is Fernweh, which is probably one of my favorite words, and these words can't be translated, but I love them, is Fernweh, which means longing, but actually also missing places where you have never been to.
Yeah.
Which is a paradox, yeah?
Right.
But it has to do with our dreams. It has to do with something subconscious, you know?
Uh-huh.
That, for example, my Fernweh place is Canada, since I was a child. And I know it sounds strange, but that's why German people have that word. In a way, I miss that place, but I've never been there.
Perfect way to end. Thank you for joining us, Javier, from Madrid, on our inaugural episode of the round of 13, but perhaps our last episode of the show. Thanks to you, Javier.
Well, thank you, Kevin.
So we have come to the end of episode 60, the end of season 5, and perhaps, or at least for the time being, the end of these radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For now, a huge thanks to Radio Fabrique for broadcasting the show in Salzburg, Austria, and beyond for the past 5+ years. Thanks especially to Eva Schmidhuber. Thanks to all the guests and collaborators and imaginers, and to Mike Allen for the free use of his songs, Sand Dune and Driffield Beats. Stay tuned and check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. for any updates and for our new projects. Ciao.